Lecture 12, Poetry.
Hello, we've now reached the 12th lecture in our series on the Hellenistic world. And in our last lecture, we had an opportunity to move away from the political record of the age and to begin an examination of what we might call the spirit of the age. How did people react and respond to the massive changes that the Hellenistic age had witnessed? And in our first attempt to answer that question, we looked at Greek sculpture and Hellenistic sculpture. And we tried to see the way in which classical sculpture had reached a certain point in its development when it was ready really to break out of its mold and to explore whole new areas, to look at different ways of looking at the human form, different ways of exploring the human psyche, different ways of expressing through sculpture the human experience. And we observed that in Hellenistic sculpture there was a great deal of freedom in the way that people went about doing this, to such an extent, in fact, that some people even refer to Hellenistic sculpture as Rococo or Baroque. It seems to be so full, so elegant, and so overblown at the same time. Well, it's now time, I think, to look at another area of artistic development to see how the Hellenistic age differed from what had come before. And this is in the realm of poetry. We've already seen in an earlier lecture on the topic of Alexandria that three of the great poets of the age all ended up at one time or another working in Alexandria. And as is so often the case, we can use the big three and we can examine their works to see how Hellenistic poetry charts new territory compared to what's come before. The three men that we're going to look at are Callimachus, Theocritus, and Apollonius. And though they produce bodies of very different work, the new directions of Hellenistic poetry will be summed up basically in the work of these three men. All of them were writing for essentially a Greek audience, and not only an audience that spoke Greek, but an audience that understood Greek education and Greek mythology. In other words, an audience of educated Greeks. They reflect a complex world in which Greek is now an international culture, but at the same time it is also a kind of exclusive club. You have to speak the language and you have to understand the references to earlier events in Greek history, but particularly to Greek mythology in order to understand this poetry. And we're also going to find that their poems are going to be unusual in that they're going to look at the daily lives of individual people. They're going to deal with themes like anxiety and nostalgia and also refinement, all of these combining to make Hellenistic poetry quite unlike the classical poetry that came before it. Let's begin first with Callimachus. Callimachus is really best remembered for his famous remark that a big book is a big evil. In other words, what he was trying to say was, I'm not going to be like Homer, I'm not going to write 24 books of epic. Instead, he preferred short, crisp poems, epigrams, often four-line poems that quickly summed up a sentiment or an idea or a feeling and an emotion, brief lyric poems. He did write a couple of longer poems, running to a few hundred lines each, and these are hymns written in honor of the gods. But even here, the style of hymn that Callimachus wrote is very different from the style of hymn that had been produced by earlier Greeks going back to, say, the 6th century. Earlier hymns, which had told the story of the gods, had tended to be fairly serious works because these were going to be recited in honor of a god. And so even though you might talk about Hermes doing something like cattle stealing, which he did when he was a little boy, nevertheless, the essential tone of the poems was quite reverential. The hymns of Callimachus really move in a slightly new direction. For example, we'll have Artemis as a little girl beseeching her father Zeus, the father of gods and men, to give her a bow and arrow so that she can go out hunting. And the scene is really comic because she's a little girl and she ends up getting a little girl's bow and arrow to play with. It's really not in keeping with the earlier atmosphere of hymns written towards the gods. Callimachus's poems are often very difficult for a modern audience to appreciate. His poems can seem stylized and overwrought, and there are moments, nevertheless, in his poems when you will find moments of real emotion, a depth of feeling which is very powerful and very moving. And I'd like to read you one such poem. It is an elegy written by Callimachus on the death of one of his close friends. Someone told me, Heraclitus, that you were dead. and brought me close to tears, for I remembered how often in our talk we put the sun to bed. You, I suppose, my Halicarnassian friend, are ashes 4 times long ago. But your nightingales still live. On them, Hades, who snatches all away, shall not cast his hand. It's a lovely poem, and the notion that the nightingales, which are the songs, the poems of his friend, will live on, is in fact an expression of a sentiment that we have long had in Western culture, summed up by the Latin tag, ars longa vita brevis. Life is short, but art is long. It survives. And this mood of gentle resignation, he's unhappy, his friend is gone, this mood of a gentle, pervasive melancholy, that life is full of sadness, we'll go on to find an even clearer voice after Callimachus, ironically not in a Greek poet from Alexandria, but in a Latin poet from Rome who, like the other good Latin poets, was thoroughly immersed in Greek poetry, who had been infused with the very same spirit of gentle resignation and melancholy, Virgil. It's in Virgil's work that this entire view of the universe will find its finest expression. Sunt lacrimae rerum, there are tears in the world is full of tears. So that Alexandrian sentiment is very personal. The comment about the relationship between life and art is something that strikes us as being very recognizable, but its ground zero is here. But Alexandrian poetry wasn't all gloom and shades of murky night. Not everything that Callimachus wrote was in honor of a dead friend, and he has some very amusing poems as well. Also, the second of the Alexandrian poets that I want to discuss, Apollonius, tried his hand at the old genre of epic, that great ancient tradition of telling the tale of heroes such as Achilles and Odysseus, the heroes of Homer's epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey. But Apollonius went out on new ground. He followed a new direction. For a start, his epic is a great deal shorter than the Homeric epics. Not only that, but also he's chosen a different story to follow. He's decided to tell the story of Jason and the Argonauts and the trip that they undertook to the Black Sea up to Colchis, to what we would call the Ukraine, in search of the Golden Fleece. Now, this story was a well-known story in Greek mythology, it's certainly true. And Apollonius' audience knew the story quite well. Like every other Greek poet, he wasn't interested in finding a new story to tell, he was interested in finding a new way to tell an old story. So the challenge that he faced was how to take this story that every Greek child had known for years and to give it something new. Well, what he came up with is quite novel and original, and the Argonautica, the epic that he wrote, is really quite a typically Hellenistic document in this sense. The hero is really not much of a hero at all. In a way, he's almost an anti-hero. What Apollonius does is to take the old genre of epic and to turn it quite on its head. What he also does, for the first time, is to really spend a great deal of time examining the individual psychology of the hero, to take us into the interior. And what we're really getting, in a way, even though it's written in the epic form, just like Homer's work, and it's an epic poem, what we're really getting, in a way, is the first psychological novel. The first attempt to really get into the head of this man. Let me give you an example that I think will help to illustrate what I'm talking about. And again, as we're talking about this, I want you to think about the way that someone like Homer would have treated this story, this particular episode that I'm dealing with. The Argonauts, these heroes of ancient Greece, have assembled in their quest to go off to get the Golden Fleece and to help Jason in his quest to become the lawful king of Thessaly. And they've landed in the course of their trip on the coast of Mysia. While there, one of the Argonauts, a young hero named Hylas, has gone off into the bush where he meets a water nymph who seduces him. So he bends down into the pool. You may have seen the glorious painting of Edward Burne-Jones that shows him about to be sucked down into the water by the nymph. He slides into her pool and she drowns him. Nymphs are dangerous business. When news comes back to Heracles, he slips into a blood-curdling rage and he storms off in search of his friend. He can't believe that Hylas is gone. He disappears and the Argonauts don't see him again. The disappearance of the greatest hero amongst all of them. Next morning, the wind freshens and one of the Argonauts urges them to set sail. Come on, we've got to cut our losses, let's get out of here. And so they set off. But they set off and then realize that they left without Heracles. They knew that Hylas was left behind, but they didn't notice that Heracles was gone. And so now, on board the boat, there is a terrible argument as the recriminations begin to fly around. And the entire band of heroes begins to disintegrate. Now, it's clearly at this moment, when all of the heroes are beginning to argue with each other, that we would expect, we'd hope, that Jason, the leader of the expedition, would step forward to assert his authority and to impose his will to restore unity. So we're getting a drum roll. This is it. We're waiting for the great hero to step forward. And this is what Apollonius says of Jason. Jason, paralyzed by an utter sense of helplessness, added no word to either side in the dispute. He sat and ate out his heart, crushed by the calamity. This is a hero who has no idea how to behave. This is Schwarzenegger finding out that the terrorists have run amok, saying, oh dear, what do I do? Not even saying that much, he can't even find the words. This, I think, is very interesting, not only because it's a new development in Greek literature. We've never had a hero like Jason before, that's for sure. But also, it's very ironic that the hero should be turning into a wimp at exactly the time in Greek history when the world is full of these superhuman men. The successors of Alexander, who wished to see themselves portrayed as the great men of the age, the men who, as I've said before, were worshipped as euergetes, benefactor, soter, savior, epiphanes, God made manifest. So there are many more superheroes in the flesh in the Hellenistic world, and at the same time, Apollonius is telling us that heroes are really not all they're cracked up to be. I can't help wondering whether there isn't something subversive in this as well, as if the whole idea of the hero is being deconstructed by this poet. Apollonius's work reveals the fascination felt by the people of the Hellenistic age towards the workings of the inner heart, the inner person, the emotional states that we experience as human beings, and particularly those emotional states that take us beyond our ordinary, everyday selves. Rage is certainly one of those states, but an even more common one is passion. And you will not find, prior to the Hellenistic period, a description quite to match the description that we have in Apollonius's work, the Argonautica, when he comes to describe the passion that has taken hold in the breast of Medea, now that she's fallen in love with Jason. Eros, meanwhile, went unseen through the grey mist, distracting as the gadfly that attacks the heifers and the cowherd's call, the breeze. Quickly beneath the lintel in the entrance, he strung his bow and took from his quiver an arrow, not shot before, to bring much pain. With quick feet he slipped unseen across the threshold and glanced sharply around. He crept, crouched low, past Jason, and fitted his notched arrow end to the middle of the string, stretched it with both hands, and shot Medea. Now, so far, this is something that you could get in earlier Greek poetry, because love is being seen here as a little figure, Eros, who has a bow and arrow, and he shoots people, and they fall in love. That much is okay. But look now at what happens in the description of Medea's response. She was struck utterly speechless. He himself darted away from the high-roofed hall and laughed aloud, but the shaft burned in the girl's heart, deep down like a flame, and she kept glancing at Jason with sparkling eyes, and her breath came in panting gasps in her distress. She forgot everything else, and her soul melted in sweet anguish. As when a toiling woman piles dry sticks around a piece of burning wood that she may make a fire beneath her roof by night, if she has waked very early, the flame from the small brand grows miraculously and consumes all the kindling. So, coiled beneath Medea's heart, there burned in secret destructive love. The colour of her tender cheeks turned now to pale, now to red. She was so distraught. So we're getting this very graphic description, both of the physical symptoms and also what it feels like. There's an attempt here by the poet to actually capture the experience, that gut-wrenching experience of actually falling in love. And this would be repeated by a number of other Hellenistic poets. It would become a staple as the poets tried to deal with what it felt like to be in love, particularly to deal with that very human experience of being in love and acting stupidly. Let me read you one. This is from the poet Philodemus. Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry, it's from the poet Rufinus. And in his poem he says this: Melisias denies her love, but her body screams that it's been struck by a whole quiver of arrows. Her step is unsteady, she catches her breath in uneven gasps. There are dark purple hollows beneath her eyes, but, loves, by your fair-weathered mother, Aphrodite, burn the faithless girl until she cries aloud and says, I burn. This is not just a love poem, it is a spell that's being cast by the poet, hoping to condemn the girl who presumably has not returned his love, so that she should burn and be consumed by this passion. Part of the complexity of the Hellenistic age arises from the fact that the artists and the thinkers of the age offered such different answers to the human dilemma. Philosophers were trying to teach people how to suppress their appetites, to control their passions. But sculptors, on the other hand, were interested in exploring these, particularly in exploring what the human body looked like when it was subjected to these. And the poets, too, were then exploring through words the sensation of losing your wits to passion. So that Apollonius's description of Medea is really a kind of literary antecedent of both Juliet and Lady Macbeth, this body overtaken. Apollonius, as much as Shakespeare, is fascinated by the inner turmoil we experience when our emotions are driven to fever pitch. In other words, when human experience is taken to the extreme. Now, the poem, the Argonautica, gave Apollonius a good opportunity to explore this particular problem, because part of the story of Jason and Medea was that they were only able to escape successfully towards the end of their expedition by killing the brother of Medea. It's a gory episode, and it's going to allow the poet to think about or to explore what it is like when people have become, in fact, killers. That's the psychology he's exploring here. So, I want to read you now the short episode that involves the death of Apsyrtus, the brother of Medea, and then we'll look at the reaction that's described by Apollonius. Now, when they had left Medea on Artemis Isle, in accord with the covenant, they separately beached their ships. Jason went to lie in ambush for Apsyrtus, and then his companions in turn. But he, deceived by these most dire of promises, quickly crossed in his ship the swell of the sea. Beneath the gloom of night, he stepped upon the sacred isle. Meeting her alone, he tested his sister with words, just as a tender child tests a stormy torrent not even stalwart men can cross, to see if she had devised deceit for foreign men. The two of them agreed on every single thing, but then, straight away, Jason leapt from his dense ambush, hefting his bared sword in his hand. Quickly, and now follow this, quickly the girl cast her eyes aside and covered them with her veil, that she not behold the brother's blood when he was struck. And Jason smote him like a butcher that smites a mighty strong-horned bull, sighting him near the temple which the Brigi who dwell upon the opposite coast had once built to Artemis. In its forecourt he fell to his knees. At last the hero, breathing his life away, scooped up in his hands the black blood from the wound and crimsoned the silvery veil and robe of the girl as she shrank away. With quick glance aslant, the implacable fury saw the murderous deed they had done, and the hero, Jason, Iason's son, cut off the dead man's extremities, and thrice licked up his blood, and thrice spat the defilement from out his teeth, just as a murderer might, in rites to expiate a slaying by treachery, and the clammy corpse he hid in the earth. There is nothing like that scene in epic prior to this time. And even though Greek plays have certainly been bloodthirsty, there's no doubt about that, most of the bloodthirsty action has taken place off stage, and all we've had is a report of it. But here, the description graphically brings it alive for us to witness in our mind's eye. So there is an interest here in a whole range of human experiences and emotions that classical art, at least in the epic, has certainly not explored. Even so, we still haven't completed the full range of what the Alexandrian poets go after. Epic, we can follow fairly well. And Callimachus's poetry too, we can find a lot in there that will resonate with us. The psychological drama of a woman torn between lover and family, we can understand a story like that. We've had stories like that in our own art. But there is a genre of Hellenistic poetry that is very difficult for us to follow, very difficult for us to appreciate because it's so unlike anything that we enjoy, and that is pastoral poetry. Poetry set in the countryside, poetry whose themes are bucolic, to do with shepherds and goatherds and the singing competitions that they enjoy. Now, the great master of this poetry was Theocritus, and his poetry is, in fact, very difficult for us to fully appreciate. First of all, we should begin by reading a little of it just to get an idea of what it sounds like, at least in English, and then we'll try to talk about why it's difficult to follow. This is the sixth Idyll from Theocritus, involving two characters called Daphnis and Damoetas. And the two of them are meant to be seen as cowherds. So we've got a couple of cowboys out on the range. And this, in Hellenistic poetry, is what two cowboys do when they meet. They sit down and they start to have a poetry competition. And the first one's poem begins like this. I won't read you the whole thing because it gets a little hard to follow, but the first one pretends that his friend over here is Polyphemus, the old Cyclops out of Greek myth. And so he says, "Polyphemus, Galatea with apples, pelts your flocks and calls you cursed in love, and a goat-herd man, and you don't look at her, you wretch, but sit and sweetly pipe. But see again, she pelts the bitch that guards your sheep, and looks to sea and barks. The lovely waves that splash upon the sand reflect her as she runs along the beach." So this is an evocation of an earlier myth about Polyphemus and Galatea, the nymph that he loved. And that's the song sung by Daphnis, and then his companion Demoetas sings back another song. "I saw her by Pan when she was pelting my flock. With one sweet eye I saw her, my only eye, with which may I see forever to the end." And he goes on about her being jealous and wasting away from the sea. "She peeps, stung by love, at my flocks and caves," and so forth. This is very difficult poetry to understand. The Greek is literally easy to understand, but it's certainly not realistic. We're not to imagine that he's really accurately recording the words of two cowboys out on the range. And the poet is certainly not psychological. It's not attempting to explore the psychology of being a cowboy. It's not about the isolation of taking care of your flocks and herds. No, this is poetry that derives from a completely different tradition. It is poetry that is concerned largely with the artifice of art, that is, the artificiality of the poem, the skill of finding sounds and words, literally syllable by syllable, that add up together to produce what the Greeks would call euphony, a lovely sound. It is almost as if when we read that, what we're really reading is like the libretto of an opera, but we're missing the music, so we can't really capture the sound of it. Tightly arranged, carefully conventional, these poems are a delight, but they're a delight to an urbane society, a society that enjoys the game of trying to recreate the countryside, and a countryside, I might add, that they never set foot in, and populating it with an imaginary world, making it a purified, sanitized landscape. It bears the same relationship to the real world as Disney's Main Street does to a real town in the USA. It doesn't reflect life so much as project an imaginary picture of how life might be if all the anxieties of crime, disease, and poverty were banished, and all one was left with was pure art. Now, for this reason, because it bears no relationship to the real countryside, pastoral poetry has very rarely been produced by poets who actually came from the countryside. Rather, it is produced in the court of King Ptolemy. It's produced in the most Hellenistic of institutions, the museum and the library. And in this court, the aulos, the circle of Greeks and Macedonians who surrounded Ptolemy, it was considered enjoyable in this self-absorbed world to create a pastoral fiction to replace the reality of the countryside, which was actually populated not by Greek poets, but by Egyptian peasants. It really is very similar, if you will, to imagining Marie Antoinette dressed up as a shepherdess with three little sheep, which she kept in the grounds of Versailles, pretending to be a shepherdess, but really having nothing to do with the lives of real peasants who all lived outside the walls of Versailles. So pastoral poetry is very difficult for us to appreciate, particularly because we don't listen to the Greek the way that the Greeks would have, with that care and attention. However, there's more in Theocritus that's worth looking at. Some of his poems are really quite remarkable because they represent a new development in Hellenistic poetry and in Greek poetry in general, and that is poems that are almost eavesdropping on the conversations of ordinary people. Now, once again, he will render this into art by writing the poems in verse, but what he captures here is the prattle of cosmopolitan daily life in Alexandria. A very famous example of this is the poem which deals with two women, Gorgo and Praxinoa, who have a conversation, and what we really get in this poem is something like a dramatic dialogue. You could almost have actors playing this out. It's almost like script of a play. And what happens in it is that you get two ordinary women, not figures from myth, not Medea, not the sorts of figures that Euripides and Sophocles would deal with, but rather ordinary ladies meeting. When, for example, Gorgo comes to the house of her friend Praxinoa, she's come inside from a great hubbub outside, and she says, "I was out of my mind to come. What with the crowd and the horses, I scarcely got to your place alive, Praxinoa. Soldiers' boots, men in military cloaks, everywhere you looked, and the road went on forever, and your house was always further and further along." It's like eavesdropping on a telephone conversation. The women then decide to go off to King Ptolemy's palace, where there's going to be a performance of a play called The Adonis, or a recital at least. And so in this poem, what we're getting is the preparation to go off to listen to this. So Praxinoa turns to her slave, and this is like something taken right out of real life. "Bring me my coat and my straw hat. Put them on properly." And then she turns to the baby. "I'm not going to take you, baby. Oh, boo, horsey bitey, cry all you like, no need for you to be maimed. Let's go, Frigia, take the little one and play with him. Call in the dog and lock the door." This is a kind of realism that Greek poetry has never had before, and it goes on with a wonderful description of them going through the streets and being almost knocked over by the king's cavalry as they come charging through, and then gradually making their way into the palace, getting tickets to go in, and then we actually get the singer singing this song, The Adonis, this recital. And of course, it's a perfect example of the kind of poetry that the court enjoyed. It's a story about Adonis, who was the lover of Aphrodite. No Egyptian would have had the faintest idea of what was going on. It's like an operatic recital. So this interest in what's going on in everyday life, and then trying to transform that into something artistic, rather than going for what was grand and heroic and something that had been found in myth, that represents the whole new spirit of the Hellenistic age. There's one particular poem that I'd like to then finish on, which I think sums this up. This is from the poet Philodemus, and he says, "I've been in love. Who hasn't? I went out and got drunk. Who hasn't? I was out of my mind. Who did it? Some god, no doubt. Well, let it go. White hairs come in place of the black. It's a sign of the age of sense. When it was time to play, I played. Now that it isn't, I'll try to put my mind to better things." A whole new world being explored by the Greek poets, producing some poetry that is marvellous, some poetry that is almost impenetrable. What it all has in common is that it is Greek poetry written for Greeks, and exclusively Greek. If one compares the produce of, say, the French or the British colonies, where we now have a whole new literature, we find that in the Greek world there is nothing comparable. There is nothing from the indigenous people. Instead, these poets are working entirely within the parameters of Greek culture, reacting to their own cultural heritage in the work of Homer, the lyric poets, and the dramatists of an earlier age.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. We hope you've enjoyed the lectures on these tapes. To order more courses or to receive a copy of our most recent catalog, call 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Or visit our website at www.teachco.com. Thank you very much for listening.